back to the Bumblecast, everyone. I am your host, Ian Flynn, the Bumble King, and joining me as always, straight from the warp pipe, is Kyle Krause.
Hello!
How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I am fan-freaking-tastic.
Yeah, we're both in a good mood this week. We got lots of good stuff going on. That's good.
We are, none of which I can talk about.
That's okay. That's okay.
But long-time listeners of the show, or at least long as last episode, will know that I had a couple of things maybe going through. And two of those things are going through. So, yay for me.
Yeah, that's...
And I will talk about it as soon as I can.
Yeah. Gotta keep this stuff under wraps. We can't have this stuff getting out. No leaks.
Sadly, no.
No leaks. So what have you been up to, Ian?
Working like crazy, because as things come down the pipe, I've got to try to stay on top of them.
Yeah.
What about you?
Have you been playing any games, watching any movies, TV, anything?
When I've had time off, there's been a couple things I've been watching. The folks at Team Four Star, who do the hilarious Dragon Ball Z Abridged series,
yes,
are doing a Nuzlocke run of Pokemon Soul Silver. Nuzlocke being a set of fan-made rules for playing through Pokemon games. And they vary depending on how severe you want your game to be, but the basics are every time you enter a new region, the first thing you encounter, you have to catch it. If you don't catch it, it counts as dead, and you can't catch it ever again. And nothing else is viable. Anything you catch, you have to name so that you form an attachment to it. And if anything is defeated in battle, it's counted as dead and you have to get rid of it.
Yeah, that's brutal.
It doesn't matter where you are in the game. Doesn't matter if this thing is carrying your team. If it dies, it dies.
Mm.
And they have lost some of their favorites in some really bad moments. But their commentary is hilarious, and the way they've been playing through has been highly entertaining.
So does that mean they can only have 6 Pokemon, and then once they're gone, they're gone, they're done? Or
No. You can catch one per region. So, you know, every time you change roads, every time you enter into a new section of the map,
okay,
you get a chance. And there's at least, you know, 3 or 4 that pop up within the grass. So, tactically speaking, there are ways that you can go to certain regions, make sure you catch a common thing, so you can go back to where it would also be common, but you can bypass it because you've already caught it and catch a more rare thing. So there, it adds a little extra layer of strategy to the whole thing.
Aha, I see. That does sound actually pretty interesting.
But if you... Yeah, it can actually make it a lot of fun, but it can also break you.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure.
When they went through, I believe it was Leaf Green, the remake of the first game,
mm-hmm,
they almost lost to the first gym leader because he almost swept their team.
Oh,
which required them to level up a bunch of stuff that they figured they were just going to keep as fodder. So it's been fun. It's been very interesting.
Nice.
Another thing we've been watching is a series called Critical Role.
Ah, yes. Which, I am familiar with Critical Role.
Yeah, there you go. It's a group of very prominent voice actors led by Matt Mercer,
mm-hmm,
doing Dungeons & Dragons. And being voice actors and giga nerds, it makes for a very, very entertaining series. Each episode is like 3 hours a pop, and we're only like 3 or 4 episodes in out of 60.
Yeah, that's about where I am.
It's been a while. It's great.
It's been a while since I've listened to them. I pretty much just treat them as podcasts, but they're fantastic. I love it.
What about you? Anything in particular you've been playing or watching?
Well, the most interesting and best thing that I've been doing recently is watched through and finished up Luke Cage, the new Marvel Netflix series.
I've heard a lot of good things about that.
And it is fantastic. I'm just going to say it. It's pretty great. It's basically, you know, you've got Luke Cage, who was introduced in the previous Netflix series, Jessica Jones, which, personally, Jessica Jones, I think, is my favorite of the Netflix shows so far. But I've also really enjoyed Daredevil a lot. But so Luke Cage is the story of a man with a lot of power. A power man, you might say.
You might say that, yes.
You might call him a man of power. A power man.
Indeed.
And basically, he's like, he's bulletproof, he's got super strength, he basically can't be hurt, his skin is impervious to most damage. But it's basically, the show's basically a really well-done, really deliberately-paced, but well-paced crime drama that just happens to have a superhero at the center of it. A super-powered guy.
I like that.
But none of the villains have superpowers, except one ends up with a super suit at the end. Spoilers. But other than that, there is really nobody is super-powered except Luke Cage. So it ends up being, you're following Luke and what he's trying to do as far as, say, as getting rid of crime in Harlem. So it's very much steeped in Harlem culture and in black culture. The cast is very diverse, lots of people of color, which is great. And really, really great acting in the show. Simone Missick as Misty Knight is fantastic. I loved her. And Rosario Dawson as Claire Temple, who's been in all of the Marvel Netflix shows since Daredevil season one, is she's the common connecting thread, and she's great, and she's finally serves her original role as Luke Cage's love interest, finally, after being in four different seasons of three different series.
I was going to say, how tightly interwoven is this with the other Marvel TV series? Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., Daredevil, Jessica Jones, all that.
All of the Netflix shows are in the same universe, and ostensibly they are in the same universe as the movies and Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. They make passing references to the movies, to events from the movies, but they don't really go further than that.
Okay. And is it like a sequel to Jessica Jones, in that Jessica Jones happens first and then Luke Cage?
Yeah.
Or are they more parallel?
Yeah, this seems to kind of happen mostly in order. So we have Daredevil season one, and then Jessica Jones follows that. And then Daredevil season two, I think, kind of coincides with Jessica Jones and Luke Cage a bit. I'm not sure. But the timeline for Luke Cage and Jessica Jones, they're definitely almost one after the other, practically. Okay. Maybe, like, a couple months. I think there's, like, 2 or 3 months separating them, but other than that, it's pretty quick, so. But yeah,
love that kind of continuity.
Yeah, they all tie together, and it's all leading up to the big Defenders crossover coming next year.
Ooh, neat. Yes.
But first, we've got to have the Iron Fist. Gotta have Iron Fist.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You can't have Luke Cage Power Man without Iron Fist. So Iron Fist will be coming in March next year, I think, and then probably October-ish for Defenders. And apparently Sigourney Weaver is the villain for Defenders, which...
I heard that.
Sounds great. I'm pretty excited about that.
Do we know who she's playing?
Nope, I don't think that's been revealed yet.
Okay. Because I'm not as familiar with that side of the Marvel Universe, so a lot of this is kind of like passing knowledge and, oh, I know that name, that's neat. And I don't have Netflix, so I'm way behind on all of these, but...
Yeah, if you can, Netflix, you know, pick up one of them 30-day trials and just blow through them all in a month if you can. Why not?
All right, if I budget out my time, I have exactly 30 minutes to eat and pee each week.
Hey, that's all you need, right?
Let's see, if I just block out all of November and do all of my script assignments,
yeah,
maybe I can just use December to watch TV.
There you go. Perfect.
That's what responsible adults do, right?
Absolutely.
Of course.
Yes. Also,
you know what responsible adults also do?
What?
They play video games.
Of course they do.
And what is perhaps the most iconic video game of all time?
Well, that would be, of course, none other than the Super Sonic Brothers.
I was going to say Pong, but yeah, okay, that works too.
Yeah, Pong. Yeah, Pong Brothers.
Bleep, said the left panel. Bloop, said the right panel.
Yes.
The die had been cast. The battle raged on.
Ho, ho, ho. I'm ready. No, really, though. Super Mario Brothers. Come on, man. We gotta talk about. We gotta finally talk about some Super Mario Brothers.
I mean, perhaps my understanding of video game history is a bit colored, but it seems like Mario, specifically Mario, was kind of the turning point where video games went from a kind of niche novelty that only a few could really access to the beginning of the home entertainment system and where everyone could play video games.
Well, you have to remember, when the NES launched back in 1985?
Oy, God, I'm old.
I think it was 85? Might be 84 even for like regional release. There was some weird stuff going on for the NES release. It wasn't an instant out-of-the-gate huge success, and they didn't release it everywhere all at once. It was a very slow process and a very slow rollout because the West, particularly in the United States, the game industry had crashed and completely imploded in on itself and was practically non-existent for a few years after 1983. So Nintendo was very cautious and very tepid to step into the waters and make sure the thing would be a success before they really dove in head first. But when the NES launched, it launched here with Super Mario Brothers. That was one of the games. And that seemed to be the most popular game. It was the one that really caught everyone's attention and made everyone sort of realize that, hey, gaming isn't just, like, Atari 2600, as great as it is. It isn't just, you know, single-screen space shooters or really tiny, quick experiences. It can really be these fully-fledged worlds that you can, you know, explore and jump around in and do all the things Mario can in. So it was really just a kind of a breakthrough for gaming in the U.S., at least. In Japan, Mario's actually kind of a slightly, I don't want to say different, but his impact was a little different because, I was recently watching, Good Intentions, a video series done by video game journalist Jeremy Parrish, where he is, chronicling, the NES library in release order. And he just got to Super Mario Brothers, and he was talking about the impact that Super Mario Brothers had on Japan. And in Japan, the Famicom, which is the Japanese version of the NES, obviously had a different impact because it was one of the last major releases or cart-based games for the Famicom before most of the development switched over to the Famicom disk system. So what it was what Super Mario Brothers was essentially the kind of the last hurrah of cartridge-based games for the Famicom, at least at that time. I think after that there were more cartridge-based games later. But at that time it was sort of the best. It was intended to be the absolute pinnacle of what you could do with the stock Famicom hardware without any sort of extra chips or additional hardware like the Famicom disk system, which was a floppy drive for the Famicom. And that's sort of what it represented for Nintendo. It was like, this is the best we can do with this hardware as it stands. So it was kind of the not really a swan song, I guess, for the Famicom, but sort of the pinnacle of what it could do. So that's sort of how it was different between the U.S. and Japan.
Fascinating.
Yeah. I thought it was really interesting when he was talking about that. I was like, wow, that's actually really cool. It's kind of the different impacts on different parts of the world.
And when you really look at the original Mario Brothers and take everything into account, it is an actually very large game, all things considered, especially with the limitations of the hardware at the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because there's, what, 10 worlds total?
No, it's 8.
8 worlds, okay, with 4 stages each.
This sets the standard of 8 worlds, which would go on for most of the series. I mean, now they've since added, like, bonus worlds and Hell, sure, X, sure, 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 X, sure. Super Mario Brothers 2, the Japanese version, had 13 worlds, but it technically, you had to beat the game, like, a few times to get past World 8, so, yeah.
And each of them are, you know, diverse in the way that they are, and yeah, they reuse assets, but they're all in interesting and different ways. So, there's still a lot of replayability. There's tons of replayability in this ancient game.
Oh, yeah.
Where all you do is jump.
Well, there are so many different ways to play it. You can do speed runs, you can do a coin challenge, you can do exploration, you can just walk around and, you know, find secrets and whatever.
I've seen the absolutely insane no-kill runs.
Yeah. There's all sorts of different things. You can challenge yourself in all sorts of ways that really I don't think you could do quite as much in games prior to it. There's just a lot more depth.
Can we really go back to that style of gaming? Because all of these retro platformers that are coming out now, retro-styled, I should say, to me it feels like they look at how limited it was back then and say, okay, we're going to have the core gameplay of the platforming, but we need a gimmick to make it interesting. We need variety of play styles. We need abilities and upgrades and whatnot, because just jumping and running is not going to be interesting enough. And yet, Mario does that. Do you think we could ever go back and go to a just flat-out, normal run-and-jump platformer and it be as successful?
And it be as successful? I don't think anything will be as successful as the Super Mario Brothers juggernaut was in the 80s, man. But I do think that there can be something as successful in terms of just being celebrated. There's been some really good, relatively simple platformers recently. I was going to say Shovel Knight, but that really isn't all that simple. There's quite a bit going on. There's quite a bit going on.
It's got its core mechanics are the action platform, but again, you've got the digging, you've got the flipping, you've got
it has
the various magic powers, the pogo jump, all that stuff.
It's very,
like I was saying, it's the core, but you add stuff to it.
Yeah, it's modeled a bit more after Super Mario Brothers 3, I suppose, with all of its items and power ups and stuff. I can't think of a really good recent example of something where you don't really have that sort of progression beyond like really basic level power-ups. I'm sure there's something out there, but I just can't think of it. But obviously it has not been as successful as Super Mario Brothers.
And I've got very, very limited experience with Super Meat Boy, and that one looks like it's very bare bones in terms of gameplay, but it's also more on precision jumping and using the momentum of your jumps and using the physics of the game, which to me is different than the Mario run and jump, where it's not so much the physics as your timing, which is probably splitting hairs, and somebody's going to say, well, actually, it's exactly the same if you look at it this way, and blah, 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 blah. But to me, it feels very different than Mario, where you have to... I feel like every example I'm coming up with is counter to what I'm trying to get at. I feel like they're very different games, okay? Just run with me.
Yeah, Super Meat Boy is more of an obstacle course-based game.
Well, there we go, thank you.
Super Mario Brothers is like an exploration-style game. It's not a... It's not really any... most of the things you have to get past aren't really that difficult. Man, I'm trying to think of something recent that is just like that's on that same level, and I'm having a tough time thinking of it.
Well, what is your experience with the Mario Legacy?
Super Mario Brothers was the very first video game I ever played.
Well, there you go.
So there is that. I think I was like, I want to say it was like 1988, 1989, so it would have been like 2 to 3 years old, and my parents bought themselves an NES for Christmas, with the pack-in being Super Mario Brothers, and they introduced me to it, and have regretted it ever since. At least my father has, legitimately, apparently, but whatever. I still would have found video games. There was no escape. Even if they hadn't been the ones to introduce me to it, I still would have found them. So, but yeah, Super Mario Brothers is where I started my gaming journey.
And did you play each of them in the series, or just a hodgepodge?
I have played almost all of them. I have played... I can't think of one I haven't played, except Super Mario Galaxy 2, which I have, but I just haven't gotten around to. Other than that, yeah, I mean, I've even played Mario's Missing and Mario's Time Machine. I don't really recommend either one, although Mario's Missing is actually okay. It's a lot easier than Mario's Time Machine. Mario's Time Machine is just complete garbage.
Mario the first. I don't think I've even heard of the second one.
Mario's Time Machine was, I think, a little less known, a little less common. But I even played Mario Teaches Typing, and I actually enjoy Mario Teaches Typing a bit. It's got its own silly charm. Mario Paint, I was into. I wasn't great at it, but I had fun with it. And trying to think what else. There's been so many Mario games. Super Mario Kart, I was really excited for. I was like, holy crap, this is awesome. I love racing games. I love car racing. I love Mario. You put them all together, I'm as excited. I think I saw it in a store just sitting there. It was like, it says Super Mario Kart. What's Mario doing racing in a little kart thing? And I was like, I want that. And I got it. And it was one of my favorite games is Mario Kart. I love Mario Kart. And yeah. What are your experiences with Mario, Ian?
Limited and shameful.
That's okay. That's okay.
Because I grew up a Genesis kid.
Yeah, well, I mean, I grew up with both. I was that guy. I mean, I had hardly any games for either one. I had Mario and Sonic games, which is all I really wanted.
I had... The only time I really got to play the original Super Mario Brothers was when I would go with my dad to a recording studio that he did a lot of work at. And in their break room, they had a Nintendo.
Mm-hmm.
So he would go to record his session, and I would try to play Mario. Try being the operative word, because not very good at Mario.
Mm-hmm.
And then the break room upgraded to a Super Nintendo, and they had Super Mario World.
Mm-hmm.
Tried to play that. My sessions with Super Mario World were usually go to Donut Plains, whatever, get Yoshi, try another level, lose Yoshi, die, go back to get Yoshi, repeat ad nauseum.
Hey, everybody loves Yoshi.
I don't know when, but I know I played some of Super Mario Brothers 2, which is really a repaint of Doki Doki Panic, but we're not getting into that just at the moment. I enjoyed that a lot, even though I had no idea what was going on or what I was supposed to do.
I love Super Mario Brothers 2.
I like the feel of it. I wish they would go back and do something like that again.
I really enjoy that game, even though it's not technically a Mario game. Although, technically, it kind of was. Its history is weird.
It's kind of been absorbed by the great amoeba that is Mario.
Well, yeah, and it was also originally designed as, like, the original design document was supposed to be, like, Mario vertically. That was the design intention. And then they kind of used that idea for a weird licensed game for Fuji Television for a special event in Japan. And then we're like, okay, this special event happened one time this one year. What can we do with this game now? And it's like, okay, Nintendo of America doesn't really like our version of Super Mario Brothers 2, so let's reskin this as a Mario game and sell it over there.
We've come full circle.
Yeah, pretty much. And then it went back to Japan and was sold again as a Mario game in the early 90s. So, they just resold this game to everybody.
The family got an N64 for Christmas one year, and Mario 64 became the kind of family mission to complete.
Oh, yes, Mario 64, man. I have really good memories of that game.
I remember being utterly blown away by the scope of it at the time.
Mm-hmm. As and was that I.
I got a tension migraine trying to get that red coin away from that chomp in Baban Battlefield. Because mm-hmm. I could not figure out the spatial relativity going into that. And when you have a giant tooth thing going, bark, bark, and you know, knocking you over,
yeah,
just I couldn't handle it. I forget how many years it took me, my dad, and my little brother to get all 120 stars, but we did it, by God!
Yeah!
We did it!
Yeah!
Dabbled with Mario Sunshine, which I did not like at all.
Oh, that's a shame. I like Mario Sunshine a lot.
The music is great. I like running around Delfino Plaza. Don't like the rest of it.
It's so pretty. And the music is wonderful.
Music is fantastic.
And I like...
It is very pretty.
I like Flood. I do like Flood. I'm a horrible person, I know, but I like that. I enjoy that mechanic. It was fun. It really changed things up. And I know it's lives in the shadow of what came before and after, but yeah, you know, it was fun. It was a good time.
I will give it this. You know, Mario 64 was the first to really blaze the trail into 3D Mario.
Right.
And Mario Galaxy feels like an extension and a refinement of that formula.
Mm-hmm.
Mario Sunshine feels like they were actually trying to experiment.
That's what it, yeah.
With the formula a bit. I don't like what they got out of it, but for a series which is kind of rife with rehash and redos, especially with the new Super Mario Brothers stuff they've been doing,
yeah,
gotta give them the props for trying something new with Sunshine.
Mm-hmm. And if there's one good thing we've gotten out of Sunshine, it's that it inspired Splatoon.
I didn't know there was a connection with Splatoon there.
Yeah, the sort of all the paint. There's the whole paint thing that Mario's cleaning up paint around Delfino Island.
Right.
That's kind of the reverse of Splatoon, and I'm pretty sure it's been mentioned in interviews that Splatoon was at least partially inspired by that.
I can see that.
Like, kind of a reverse version of that, I suppose, where instead of cleaning up, you're making everything a mess, but, you know. It was sort of inspired by that, it seems like.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And, I don't know, maybe for me personally, I find that I enjoyed the spin-offs of the Mario World a bit more than main core Mario.
Mm-hmm.
Mario RPG, fantastic. Paper Mario, especially Thousand Year Door. The Mario Kart series. Luigi's Mansion.
Mm.
I really wish I had been able to play more of it, but Super Princess Peach.
Super Princess Peach is actually a lot of fun, and I think it's very overlooked.
The Donkey Kong series.
Mm-hmm.
The Wario Land series, you know, all these weird little things that were introduced in Mario first that budded off and became their own entities, except for Super Princess Peach, but that's probably a whole long rant about sexism within the industry. But besides the point, Yoshi's Island, for pity's sake.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, all these different things that all spin out just from one little plumber.
Yeah, one of my favorite things about the spin-offs is the sports games. The sports games are actually a lot of fun and really good.
They are very solid.
Mario Super Strikers, I think. Yeah, Mario. Is it Super Strikers or is it just Mario Strikers? I forget.
I think Strikers was the first one.
Yeah, one of those. Either way, they're both great. I think those are the best of the sports spin-offs of the soccer ones.
Well, that one feels like it has... I don't know, like it had a different director or something involved, given the extremely, almost Majora's Mask-esque art style with all the heavy inks and the jagged lines.
It looks great. I love it.
And the attitude that the characters have. It's like some of these poses and some of these trash-talking moments, like, this is a Mario game? Nintendo let this go through? All right, I'm happy with it. Go for it.
Yeah, it was almost Sonic levels of like 90s toot going on. I thought it was great. I really need to go back and play a bit more of Mario Strikers. I haven't played nearly enough.
Although I feel like the Mario sports franchise has worn a little thin with folks considering that the last two outings had been compilations of them instead of standalones.
You mean the Mario and Sonic Olympic Games ones, or?
No. The standalone, the individual Mario ones, which in a lot of cases almost feel like here's the Olympic Games just without the Sonic cast or the Olympic logo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess that's true. Mario Super Sluggers is kind of cool for Wii.
Mm-hmm.
I think it works really well with the Wii Remote, you know. It's a bit more of an in-depth baseball game, building on the simplicity of the baseball game in Wii Sports. I like that one a lot. And
was that the one that brought back King K. Rool and Funky Kong?
It might be. I know that it had one of the Kremlings in it, for sure. One of the Donkey Kong Country Kremlings. He was just kind of a generic, one of the generic enemies. I don't remember if it was King K. Rool in there or not.
I know one of the baseball games had the two of them in there because Funky Kong used the surfboard as his bat.
Nice. That's probably, it probably was. They're probably just unlockable and I never saw them. That's really cool. So, but what's your experience with, some of the pre-Super Mario Brothers stuff? Like, have you even played Mario Brothers or Donkey Kong or anything like that?
I remember playing the original Donkey Kong arcade cabinet at a local pool when I was little.
Mm-hmm.
And that office NES I mentioned, there was Duck Hunt and original Donkey Kong and Super Mario Brothers, which I didn't get to play a lot of, you know, usually 30 minutes to an hour, depending how long the work session was.
Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't say I had a lot of experience. If I had had more, I might be better at Mario than I am, but maybe it's because I was not weaned on that system, that I grew up on the Little Blue Hedgehog instead. Might explain why I am just so abysmally bad at Mario. Case in point, a friend of mine, David, a.k.a. Night Train, who runs Nightworks, which is a series of game review blogs and web series and whatnot, gifted me a copy of New Super Mario Brothers on the Wii U. Because he happened to have an extra copy, sent me the download code. I figured, why not? Free game.
Yeah.
He says, how are you enjoying it after like a month or so? I said, I'm still on World 2 and I've already got at least 3 game overs.
Oh.
He got real quiet. And he says, how?
Yeah.
They throw lives at you. I go, I know, David. I know. I can't Mario. I appreciate him for what he is. He is an absolute pinnacle icon of the franchise. There's a ton of polish and love put into the games, and even if the new Super Mario Brothers to me looks like it's retreading a lot of the same ground,
it's
still stylish, it's still pretty. Super Mario Maker is a phenomenal idea.
Oh man, Super Mario Maker is one of the best things about the Wii U.
But I cannot play this bloody thing to save my life.
Oh, man. That's a shame. You know, I'll come over there and we'll play New Super Mario Brothers together. We'll play through it.
Yeah, you do that and, you know, I'll float around in a little bubble in the background going, help! Help! And you go, sorry, again, you're a liability.
It's all good. It's all good.
All of a sudden, your Mario's got like some camo paint on, carrying the AK-47. Come with me if you want to leave. Aren't you mixing your references there, Kyle? Don't talk to me. You're the one making up this terrible reference. Come on. Why is he Russian or German? Mario, what are you doing now? Shut up. I'm going to kill Bowser. Let's go.
That's exactly what'll happen. I gotta
say, get through anything because I'm gonna be rambling on and on in the bad Arnold voice, and you're gonna be cracking up.
That's probably true.
Double liability on my part.
I will say though that Super Mario 3D World, excellent game. I freaking love that game. That's probably my favorite Mario game in like 20 years.
That's the one that's kind of isometric, where Peach and Toad come back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
See that I like that one because that again it. It's the retro callback, but it feels newer than a lot of the new Super Mario Brothers stuff.
yeah, the worlds are really cool and really creative. There's one made entirely of desserts. You know, they kind of stole some ideas from Sonic Colors, I think, but, you know.
Sonic Colors stole some ideas from Mario Galaxy, so, you know.
Yeah, they kind of go back and forth, really, honestly. But, it's just a really fun experience. And Rosalina's playable in it, which is always good in my book.
Yep.
I do like Rosalina a lot. And, yeah, it's just a lot of fun.
I'll see if I can hunt it down and put this link in the text at the bottom of the YouTube video. If I can find it, I may have lost it, in which case it'll be sad. But somebody went into Super Mario Maker and custom built a stage based off of Sonic and Mega Man Worlds Collide.
Really?
Yep.
That sounds freaking cool.
I can't remember exactly all that went into it, but the fact that they went in and made a stage based off of the comic was just amazing. I loved it.
Yeah, that's really cool. I like how there's some game developers that are using Super Mario Maker, and you can play through their levels and kind of get a feel for the way they design games versus how, you know, Nintendo would design levels generally. Mm-hmm. I know there's one, Koji Igarashi, you know, formerly of the Castlevania series, now doing Bloodstained Ritual of the Night.
Right.
He apparently put together some really cool levels in Super Mario Maker, one of which was a really solid remake of, I think, the first stage of the original Castlevania.
Oh, wow.
I mean, obviously it doesn't really look like Castlevania because it's couched in the Super Mario art style, but it really actually turned out really well, and it looks great, and it seems to play really well too. So
what is a plumber? A miserable pile of secrets. Have at you! Ha ha! Oh, what a terrible night for a curse.
Ah, that's great.
No, it's not.
I'm laughing, so whatever. It's funny. I'm laughing. That's all that matters, isn't it? So, one last thing I wanted to bring up, Ian, before we shift gears a bit and get into some Q&A. Recently, there was an interview, recently translated, with Miyamoto. And he was saying that Mario is apparently 24 years old.
I've seen that number going around. I was wondering where that came from.
Do you think that is a believable age for Mario?
Given how absolutely bonkers and fanciful that world is.
Yeah.
Sure. I mean, it's a realm where you can warp to completely different biomes via pipes. Where one day everything turned to gold because...
Sure.
Where you can eat a mushroom and turn into a cat. No, excuse me, that's a bell. I do beg your pardon.
Yes, that is a bell.
Point being, you knock a bell out of a floating box and turn into a cat. If all of that is baseline okay, having a guy with that much of a mustache at 24, sure, why not?
That's true. I
don't think anybody on this hemisphere would have said younger than like 34.
Yeah, that's what I thought. It was like, that's what I've always thought. It was like maybe mid-30s.
Because it feels like he's kind of the working class man. He's seen some stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And given how storied his journey has been through the Mushroom Kingdom and beyond, you would think that he's put some years behind him. But who am I to argue?
Well, you look at, like, all of the live-action interpretations we've had of Mario, regardless of whether they're canonical or not, they are still representations of the character in media. The voice acting and stuff we've had were, aside from Charles Martinet's performance, pretty much all Marios are, like, you know, deep-voiced Italian guys.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's they always seem to be guys who are, you know, a little bit older, a little bit more mature, and you know, that's kind of how I've always thought of Mario, is kind of maybe in his, like, yeah, his mid-30s or something like that. Also, you know, getting an education to be a plumber, to be an actual plumber, not just a plumber's apprentice, that takes quite a long time, generally.
As a matter of fact, my brother-in-law is doing that right now.
Yeah.
And just listening to the stories of the hoops he's had to jump through and all the work he's going to put into it is harrowing.
Yeah, so it's a lot of work to do that, and getting that at 24...
Not to mention being a licensed doctor and space explorer pilot, Renaissance painter.
There really isn't anything Mario hasn't done. Basically,
professional dinosaur rider,
professional
more of a niche market,
professional player of various sports at an an Olympic level for some of them.
Yeah.
Basically, Mario is 24, and yet has somehow done all of this stuff.
If he didn't make you feel inadequate already.
Years must be very long in the Mushroom Kingdom. Maybe that's what it is. It's a different time
scale. Sure, why
not? It's a different time scale. That's what it is.
Something that's come up, I've been asked a lot. Uh-huh. If we got a Mario comic, what would I do with it? And would I approach it the same way as, like, Sonic or another way?
Mm-hmm.
And having looked at it a lot, and of course this is with a number of provisos because it depends on what Nintendo would want us to do with it, what they would allow us to do with it, yada, yada, yada.
Yeah.
It's really tempting to take the Sonic approach with it and try to give it this thread of continuity to hammer out what are the limitations? What is the geography of all these different kingdoms and worlds? How does the science, quote unquote, work with these? You know, what are the taxonomy of all the different monsters? And I don't think that really works for Mario. I mean, you can definitely, if you want to just bury yourself elbows deep in and work on it, it's possible.
Sure.
But I think part of the fun and part of the appeal of the Mario mythos is that it's so fanciful, and there are really no limits as to what you can encounter, that trying to make it conform within certain parameters kind of loses some of that whimsy.
Mm-hmm. I would agree.
So I think I would try to approach it with that kind of laissez-faire, open-minded approach. You know, if one day aliens are invading? Sure, why not? One day he turns into a 2D piece of paper? Yep, that works because it's Mario's world. Yeah. That's just how it goes.
Absolutely. All right, I think we've pretty much wrapped up the Mario discussion. I think we had some good discussion on Mario.
We paid him excellent lip service.
Yeah,
bushy,
sure.
24-year-old mustachioed service.
Yeah, maybe we'll revisit this topic in the future. We'll talk about some of the spinoffs and stuff.
Sure, but now it's time to announce our Bumble Raffle winner!
Yeah! Let's do it.
Now, the Bumble Raffle is our contest per episode where you get to win a signed comic from me, mailed to you, so you can enjoy it, frame it, laugh at it, whatever you want to do. It's your book. Now, if you're already a patron of the show at patreon.com/bumblecast, you are automatically entered into every single draw. If you are not a patron, that's not a problem. Just write in, and every show, you get put in as another chance. So, you got to write in every show, but you still get the same chances as the folks who are a patron.
Yeah.
So, this episode's winner is...
Daniel L!
Woo! We'll be contacting you to ask you about your mailing info and get that book to you as soon as we can.
Congratulations, Daniel. Enjoy that comic. Enjoy the heck out of it. Read it. Million times. At least. I want proof.
And for a brief moment here, we're going to shift gears tonally as we have a ad for the show. It's a bit of a somber one, but it's a very good message. It comes to us from our good friend Daniel H., who is kind of the patron saint of the show, to be honest.
Yeah. That guy rules.
And he says, a friend of a friend of his is in need of a serious signal boost. Her name is Amber Hudson, and she's in the fight for her life. She's in the first stage of breast cancer and could really use your help. Please follow the link below if you are on YouTube. We'll have that in the links below, but I'll read it to you in just a second. It's a link to her GoFundMe page, and consider donating whatever you can. Just spread the word. Get her the help that she needs. And the address is www.gofundme.com/2nj0ug4. And knowing friends who have had to fight that fight myself, it is not pretty. So anything you can do to help her out, especially in these early stages, would definitely be appreciated, I'm sure, by her and by Daniel, and by extension, us here at the Bumblecast.
Yeah, definitely. Cancer is not something you mess around with.
Not in the slightest.
No.
So best wishes to you, Amber, and if you happen to be listening, hopefully the Q&A here will get your mind off of things for just a couple minutes.
Yep. All right. Let's go ahead and get in a question from the Patreon priority Q&A.
Now, the priority Q&A is for our patrons over at patreon.com/bumblecast. It's almost like I keep plugging that for some reason.
Whatever.
Now, you can get your question put on the Bumblecast at any time with bumblecast@yahoo.com, on Twitter @IanFlynnBKC or @KyleJCRB, #Bumblecast. Or if you are a patron, just ask it within the message or in the comments section. But that all gets put into the queue. And how many questions do we still have in that queue, Kyle?
Quite a few for the standard Q&A. We got a couple episodes worth at least.
Mm-hmm. So we'll get to it.
Yes.
But if you have that burning question that you need answered right now, head on over to patreon.com/bumblecast. I keep plugging that. I don't know. It's a condition.
It's weird.
Toss a couple dollars our way, you could put in the priority queue, and you'll be probably answered in the next episode, because we burn through those really fast.
Yes, we do.
All right, so our priority questions for this episode are...
First one comes from Yams88. Good friend Yams. I like Yams, they're delicious.
Yams has been with us for a while, too.
I know, Yams is great.
And he has some very dedicated followers, I like that.
And Yams are great. I mean,
they are.
The vegetable and the person.
So, all 88 of them.
Yes. Anyway. As someone who has to read and interpret an ever-changing series to meet a coherent storyline, what do you suggest to the fans trying to adapt to 25 years of changes from within the series? One of the things that keeps the fandom alive is the creative content others create based on their unique interpretations, but some seem reluctant to speak up anymore out of fear. Some are even worried by the various changes. What are your thoughts?
Now, I've been stewing on this question for a bit, and I feel like I'm missing something. But let's take it bit by bit here.
Okay.
Now, in terms of how the series has changed over 25 years, I'm assuming that means just Sonic in general. You know, how it's gone from the first game to the modern interpretation to its various incarnations, Werehog to Riders to what have you. And to that I say, just enjoy the ride. You know, Sonic has always experimented heavily on its gameplay style and the direction. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but it's always something interesting. And there's pretty much always something cool to be had out of all the games.
Mm-hmm.
Like, just off the top of my head, Sonic and the Secret Rings. The idea to have a control scheme that you have to level up to be better, not the best idea. But the setting and the music and the design aesthetic and the story and all the hidden big cameos, all of that was phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, take the good with the bad. And with any franchise, it's not going to please everybody all of the time. So instead of dwelling on what you didn't like at this one point, celebrate what you did enjoy. And always tell the creators what you enjoy and what you didn't in a civil and constructive fashion and see where it goes from there. I mean, Sonic Colors was the result of folks saying the daytime stages in Sonic Unleashed were fantastic. We didn't want any more Werehog. What you got was this concise, tight, fast platformer. I love Colors so much.
Colors is excellent. And followed up by the equally great Generations.
Yes. And folks were saying, we want more classic style gameplay. While others were saying, no, stick to the boost to win system. What we got was Generations, where you have classic gameplay and boost to win stuff. And it all worked out so well.
Yeah, very well balanced. Very good.
So in that regard, I just say, you know, it's been 25 years. They got to change things up. I approach it with this kind of excitement about where's it going to go next. It's interesting to me. Now, the second part here is talking, I'm as far as I can interpret it, that fandom kind of keeps things alive, which I agree.
Yeah.
That there's a lot of interesting ideas out there, and I'll agree with that too. I unfortunately have to kind of skate along the fringe for various reasons, but you know, the fan art I see of the official material is great. Not seeing where the fear comes from. Because as far as I know, nobody is really stomping on fan creative ideas. I've asked folks not to present them to me personally, just because I don't want to open up myself to allegations of intellectual theft. I don't want somebody's fan character to, or somebody who has a fan character, I should say, think that I cribbed their idea.
Mm-hmm.
99% of the fans out there would be ecstatic to see some form of their creation legitimized in the book. That 1% who would not and make a problem ruins it for everybody else. But I've got to protect myself and the work because of that. But that by no means is me trying to snub anybody doing their creative endeavors. I mean, if you've got a fan character, if you've got a fan comic, fan game, I mean, the things people are making now are absolutely phenomenal. I mean, have you seen the custom levels built off of the Generations engine?
Yeah.
It's insane.
Great, yeah.
So, somebody actually did a Rainbow Road built in the Generations engine.
Oh,
bring it back to Mario.
I have to look that up, man. That sounds awesome.
But anyway, I mean, just because I can't look at it doesn't mean I'm not encouraging you to do it. By all means, go create, live, do. All the more power to you. As far as I know, Sega is fairly lenient about that sort of thing. Not that I can speak for them, but I haven't heard of them coming down hard on fan creations like Nintendo has. So I'm not sure what that fear is.
Yeah, I'm not entirely certain either. Maybe it's a fear of the... maybe it's more related to the comic. Like, they're fearful that changes are going to happen again, that things are just going to get rebooted again or something. I'm not sure. Like, are they just...
Well, I mean, in that regard, it's kind of one of those things where you have to accept that you can't control that sort of thing.
Right.
I don't foresee it happening. I know that, at least on my end, as far as I can go, I've taken great pains to guard against it. But, you know, there's other things way beyond my controls, things that I don't even know about that could potentially walk in. Who knows? But if you spend all your time worrying about what might happen, potentially, theoretically, on the horizon, you're going to spend, you know, many sleepless nights waiting for the meteor to hit instead of enjoying what we have now.
Exactly.
So I guess that's my ultimate answer, is live for the moment, enjoy what we got, don't worry, be happy. Hakuna Matata?
Yeah.
Buy the book? I don't know.
Always buy the book.
Shrug?
Buy all of the books. Every one of them.
High falsetto voice? Questioning tone?
Our next question comes from Michael B. Are we going to get any more closure on the Shattered World arc / Panic in the Sky before Genesis of a Hero? It seems a bit absurd to have to wait about 3 or 4 months before we get any closure because of an anniversary arc. To be more specific, I'm talking about closure on Nicole's condition.
This one's kind of multifaceted. First off, Shattered World arc / Panic in the Sky is done. That's the end. That's the finale. That's like the credits rolling and you wanting more. Well, obviously you want more. I want you to want more, but that's the end. That's the end marker. So it's not like I'm trying to lead you on, I guess. Another thing is, you got to remember that the Sonic book is a marketing tool for the franchise. I try to do a lot more with it, obviously, but it exists to promote Sonic. And sometimes these events come into play regardless of where they're going to fall into the narrative. So not everything is completely under my control when it comes to pacing. And I guess number three, who's to say that even without the anniversary arc, we would resolve Nicole's condition in the very next issue, you know?
Right.
It's an ongoing story. Maybe that would be something I would draw out to explore a bit. Maybe I would follow up on it. You don't know. That's part of the story. It's going to come eventually. If we tell it all in one go, well, you couldn't tell it all in one go. I don't have that many pages. I don't think there's enough trees to print that many pages.
Well, there must be, because it's eventually going to happen, right?
I mean, I can understand being put out having to wait through the anniversary event to get back to the main narrative. But at the same time, this is a Sonic book. You know, adaptations and acknowledgments of the source material have popped up all the time over the past, what, 15, 20 years?
Yeah.
This ain't nothing new, so I wouldn't call it absurd, but maybe that's just me.
All right, and our last priority question for this episode comes from Zephyr Flame. You mentioned a while back that you don't have much communication with the art team after you send off the script. Do you enjoy seeing the finished product and the art team's take on what you wrote? Are there any specific examples of when they depict a scene better than what you had imagined in your head?
It's funny because I, in a general rule of thumb, I don't have a lot of contact, and yet sometimes I do have a lot. So It really varies time to time. I love seeing the final product because I've been at this for so long. A lot of it isn't really new anymore, if you know what I mean. It's kind of standard. It's the job now. I understand how it goes. It feels familiar.
Yeah.
So having the pages come in without me being able to, you know, see it beforehand is a lot of fun because it's like, oh, I get a new comic today. I wrote this. I'm actually correcting it. Still, I get a new comic today. Yee! And I know there's got to be a scene or two that was just beyond my expectation. There was an issue of Sonic X, number 17, I think, by Steve Butler. It was our St. Patrick's Day themed issue. And there's one panel in particular where Eggman's flying off in a giant leprechaun mech against a giant rainbow. And I was crying. I was laughing so hard. It was just perfect.
Oh, man. I have to look that up. That sounds hilarious.
Pretty much the entirety of Mega Drive. I mean, I know Tyson Hess is good.
Oh, yeah. Mega Drive is gorgeous.
I mean, I specifically wrote the script with him in mind to play to his strengths, which is everything. But even still, when the art came in, it was just amazing. And he and Matt Herms are a just dynamite team.
Yeah.
The Blackout of the World sequence, which I'm pretty sure that was Ryan Jampol and Matt Herms. It's been a while since I actually looked at Mega Man. We had a lot of folks coming through on the art on that.
Yeah.
But that entire sequence was really solid. That whole issue. You know what? Pretty much anything by Ryan and Matt, I think, was pretty much on the money.
Yeah. Ryan is great. I love his art.
Anything to do with the Everybody versus Every Robot Master sequence by Ben Bates.
Man.
And again, Matt Herms at Worlds Collide. I mean, some of these things, I know I push the envelope sometimes, and I expect the artist to, you know, maybe dial it back or find a workaround or say, Ian, you're insane. Here's what gets the idea across without breaking my hand. It's like, okay, that's fine. We compromise. It's an artistic endeavor. You know, you got to move a little bit on both ends.
Right.
But people like Adam Bryce Thomas and Tyson Hess and Ben Bates and such, they look at the script and they go, okay, and they just do it.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, you're spoiling me. Okay.
You are talented. Holy crap.
Which isn't to say the folks who don't, you know, go that crazy are shortchanging the book by any means.
Right. No, not at all.
You know, they have lives to live. They don't need to be spending the next 3 days drawing one page.
Yeah.
But I know there's like probably another 100 examples I can't think of immediately, but it's always fun to see something new, to get that page fresh, even though I wrote it. And because of the way that things are so delayed in terms of production, because, you know, I've got scripts well done in advance, optimally, just so that, you know, while I'm writing one issue, another issue is already being penciled, and another issue is already being inked, and another issue is already being colored if things are running right. So by the time a issue comes in to go over, it's been like three or four months at least. I've already forgotten what I was working on. So it's like, oh, this is fresh and new. Oh, yeah, this is fun.
Has it just come to a point where you're just like so entrenched in writing this that you kind of end up forgetting what you've written just because you've written so much and it's just like all jumbled in your head, I guess. I don't know, something like that.
Well, sometimes I have to go back and refresh myself on the finer details, mm-hmm. but I've got the majority of the story in my head.
Okay.
I remember where I've been and where I'm going with all this. It's just, you know, when I'm focusing on this issue.
Yeah.
The other one's, you know, out of my head. It's the points, the information that I'm using to continue the story is there. But, you know, exactly how I had this scene staged or this one funny line, that doesn't necessarily stick with me. And then I see it again. It's like, ah, that worked. That was funny. I don't care if I wrote it.
Yeah.
And it's on an even more extreme level is, you know, when folks actually get the issue when it's published and they're getting all excited and they're enjoying it and they're reacting to it. And I'm like, oh, yeah, that storyline, that's old news. I'm on this one over here, and I'm planning like 3 years ahead. I'm so glad you're enjoying it now, but I live in the future.
I knew it. You're the secret. You're a secret time traveler.
I am the Silver the Hedgehog I knew of this it. Franchise.
I knew it.
I mean, well, I do. I try.
Are we ready for some standard Q&A?
I think we're ready for some standard Q&A.
All right. This one comes courtesy of Red Hammer. Hey, Ian, in the Archie Sonic comics... Oh, hey, what's up? In the Archie Sonic comics, during the Station Square rescue story, why are the residents mixed with both humans and animal people? Creatively, whose idea was that?
We'll go in reverse. Creatively, that was my idea, and because I'm approaching the world in the comics as more mixed of human and animals. Mobians, whichever term you prefer.
Sure.
Canonically, there are two worlds, but the comic is its own kind of thing. So while I'm definitely steering it closer to game canon, it's also kind of doing its own thing to be special and unique, like a snowflake, a butterfly snowflake. Unique and special. That's what I'm doing with it.
Sounds good to me.
That, and in the previous run of the comic, there was this underpinning of racial tension between humans and Overlanders and Mobians and whatnot that I don't think worked most of the time. And Sonic's world, game-wise, is, I think, a little more bright and optimistic than it was during that period of the book.
Mm-hmm.
So I prefer to think of Sonic's world as a largely functioning, happy, not utopian, but nice place. And Eggman is really just kind of the dark smear on it. So gone is the racial tension between the cartoon animals and cartoon people. They pretty much coexist.
I kind of prefer that, to be honest.
Little less Animal Farm, more Dragon Ball.
Yeah, that's fine. I'm okay with that. And this next question is pretty timely, considering the new Godzilla movie, the Japanese Godzilla movie, just got its limited release here in the States. This one comes from Sonic Blue Ranger. Since you have your foot in the door at IDW, have you ever considered pitching a Godzilla comic?
I wouldn't say foot so much as large toe, but man, I would love to write a Godzilla comic.
I love me some good Godzilla.
I mean, what is there not to love about Godzilla? From the spines to the atomic breath to the... I mean, you gotta love Godzilla.
I can't think of anything, really. I mean, yeah, there's really nothing.
Now, that's not something I'm working on right now. I don't see it in the immediate future, but this past month has been nothing but projects that I hadn't foreseen. So, who knows? I would love to do a Godzilla book, though.
Yes. That would be awesome. Is there currently a Godzilla comic? I would assume
at least one. Maybe two.
Maybe.
I'd have to review, but I think what IDW's Godzilla approach is a number of self-contained arcs, which is kind of like approaching it like individual Godzilla movies, kinda which like are kind of in continuity, kind of their own thing, which I think is the best way to do it.
Yeah, that actually makes a lot of sense. Because, I mean, you have the different eras of Godzilla, and now we have the new era starting up again with the new Shin Godzilla movie, which I kind of want to see. It's kind of a shame it's really limited release.
I don't think anywhere around here is playing
that. I probably should figure that out soon. So anyway, next question comes from Next Walt Disney. Last question here. Will the Freedom Fighters ever have individual rivals? Not necessarily enemies or villains. But like, you know, I guess Knuckles style rivals? Like Knuckles is the rival for Sonic?
How can I answer this one satisfactorily? So Nicole kind of already has one in Phage, but that's definitely villain, not rival.
Right.
For Antoine, and then with Bunny, I was thinking something of... Rotor's got enough baggage with his dad being an egg boss. And Sally, I feel like she gets so much focus just by virtue of who she is in the team. I think if she had a personal rival, that would kind of overburden her with attention at the moment. Or... open me up to yet more claims of favoritism. Hi, Vey.
How dare you?
Yeah, I know. So, no, I think that's as much as I can hint at for right now.
How dare you write characters in a story and some of them happen to have more focus than others? How dare you?
I know. I'm a horrible person.
I knew it! You finally admit it!
If you would like daily updates about how awful I am, go to bumbleking.com or follow me at Twitter at IanFlynnBKC.
Do that. And of course, you can follow me at KyleJCRB, and you can find what I'm doing at KNGI.org. And you can find me streaming live every Saturday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time at 8bitx.com, where I'm streaming live video game music and video game music remixes and awesome stuff for you to listen to. And just generally having a good time. So if you're bored on a Saturday evening and want to tune in over at 8bitx.com, it would be awesome. We've got a chat room set up and everything, so you can chat with me in person and say, hey, your music's good, but you should be quiet and just let the music play. You can do that. That's fine.
We're going to wrap up the show with a shout-out to all of the patrons who make this show possible. For everyone who's been with us for the long haul, thank you so much. And for everyone who's new, thank you, too. You're always welcome. So big thanks to Daniel H., Zephyr Flame, Deus Miles, Yams88, Mike B., Fancy Fool, Connell T., Daniel L., congratulations again on winning the Bubble Raffle, Samuel P., Justin G., Jennifer R., Andrew F., John M., S. Yovatovich 9X, Alex P., and James K. Once again, thank you all.
You are super awesome.
That's going to wrap us up for Bumblecast episode 28. We will see you in 2 weeks for Bumblecast episode 29!
Yeah! Okay.
Good night, everybody.
We're done.
That segue to the end worked out really well.
We're done. I mean, there was a little bit of a pause in there while I tried to figure out where to go next, but hey, no, that's why we
that's what editing is for.
That's why we invented editing.
We, specifically, the two of us.
Of course, we invented editing. Hey, thanks for listening to the Bumblecast. If you like the show, be sure to hit that subscribe button and consider supporting us on Patreon. We have some great rewards as well as big plans to make the show even better. Also, rate and review the show on iTunes. It gets more folks listening and really helps us out, so we definitely appreciate it. Original music by Ken Coda Snyder, used with permission. Find more of his music at bc.s3m.us and find the theme song at noisechanradio.bandcamp.com. Available as a pay-what-you-want download.